Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Thank you all for coming. It's going to be a good topic today. And TMR member, Jason Body, that's not how you say it, is going to introduce our keynote speaker. So, Jay.
Good morning to you all. Again, my name is Jay Subedi, and I work at Interfaith Works as a housing service coordinator, and I'm current on the board with the OCL. It's been exciting last 3-4 years as a board of director. Before introducing Dr. Rasmi, today's topic is mostly related with the refugee issues in the U.S. and is across the global issue too as well now. Let me go back and tell a little bit about my story, being refugee and came as a refugee 7 years ago. I was born in Bhutan. Bhutan is a small, tiny kingdom between India and China. And at the age of 12, the government made a plan to have a ethnic cleansing. So I was evicted along with my parents, and great to see some of my former refugee friends on the table from representing the school district today. At the age of 12, I was admitted in Nepal as a refugee under and designated by the UNHCR. There were 7 camps and 120,000 refugees staying in Nepal. And fortunate that we have only few thousands left today, and because of all this resettlement process, everybody's having new life as I have today. But we spent terrible life, 18 years of life in the refugee camp, and finally the process, the U.S. agreed to resettle the Bhutanese refugees from Nepal in U.S. is 60,000. And I was one of the top 10,000 in the initial phase of life to start the new life in U.S. So I came here on 2008, November, next month. November 13th would be my 8th year in U.S. I still remember landing at JFK and coming to Syracuse on November 14th, and next day it was a snow. I didn't know that how to wear the snow boots, and nobody told me. So I was, that's a true story, and I said every time. And I was trying to walk outside the home with a bare foot. So that's my first experience. But engage with the community so deeply, and I'm glad to see some of my Northside group here that they know me very well, how deeply I'm engaged with the community. So I had my life working 2 jobs, 80 hours per week, subway at downtown. If you have stopped any time between 2009 and 10, I used to make a sandwich at the South Warren Street. And that was the initial phase of life. And then also, I did interpreter at Interfaith Works at the beginning. And then I was hired as a case manager, and I had my case manager job for last 7 years and to the new position now as a housing service coordinator. Going back to those 7-8 years life in U.S., I have learned so much. And as I said before, I'm deeply involved in the community, no matter whether with the street level, the task force meeting or the TNT meetings or the neighborhood groups or the city or the county or the states. And I know most of you and many of you know me very well. And I was deeply involved in the study at our doorstep because I was a refugee that time. And because there are so many questions about refugees, who these people are. Still, I'm facing today on the ground. When I go for finding the housing, quality housing and the apartments, I come through this question, who these people are, where they come from, why they are coming to Syracuse, who welcomed them, who pays for them, is our taxpayer money? So now I have an answer. I was a refugee, and now I'm a new American, and I'm giving back to the community, and I'm paying the taxes. So I have the answer for those landlords that asked me that question. But the truth is, when we had a study done, I think if you had already gone through all that, the study book, but it's not only that answered the questions from city and the county, but it has answered the questions from the across the U.S. I represented many national level conference, and I always tell this study is done in our doorstep, and it was done in my doorstep because I was a refugee, and the study was about me and my fellow community members and the refugees that come to our community from the globe. So I was fortunate to be involved in the study, and I was a panelist as well. And from there, I have an opportunity to join the board. And today, we are doing great work. And thank you, OCL. Thank you, TMR, all the members. This is really nice, cool things that I don't think any other community that does across the nation regarding has this kind of concerned citizens, civically engaged people in the community. So that was my story. And Greg is laughing, and he knows me. And we were together at some point. So during those time, mostly the Bhutanese refugees across the globe, still today, we have a high rate of suicidal. I think Dr. Rasmi will present on her study, but as a community member, as a community leader, and as a concerned community member, we found that we have a lot of societal death in this country since resettlement has begun. It was 22% nationally, which is double the numbers of the national suicidal rate in the U.S. within one community. And I know that because we came from different part of the world, different culture, different background, different story, different religion, different so many things that includes there. But without being delayed, I think we'll get more appropriate answer and more correct answer from her. From our study. So Dr. Rasmi is an assistant professor at the Department of Marriage and Family Therapy. Her areas of research inquiry include family relationships and mental health of refugees resettled in the U.S. and the therapeutic process in the family systems therapy. She completed her doctoral and postdoctoral work in the couple and the family therapy program at the Ohio State University and Master of Philosophy in Psychiatric Social Work from the National Institute of Mental Health and Neuroscience in Bangalore, India, where she has trained to provide systemic therapy with individuals and families experiencing severe and chronic mental illness. Rasmi said that the OCL study, the world at our doorstep, was very useful for her when she was putting together her study on refugees and the changing family experience in the new country. So without being delayed, please welcome Rasmi Gangamma in the stage. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This is just such an honor for me to be here. As Jay was mentioning, as I was putting together the study, which was in 2014, one of the first things that I looked at was your report. And so when Eileen mentioned the, you know, coming and speaking here, I was like, yes, I'd love to do that. So I just wanted to start off with a brief introduction. I am not a refugee. I am in the process of becoming a permanent resident. I'm still a guest worker in this country. I'm from India. I had not worked with refugees until 2014. Previously, my research interests were in the area of clinical processes, so what helps people to change in therapy. When I got here to Syracuse and I started my job at Syracuse University, as I was trying to learn more about the community, I found out that there is a large population of refugees. And at that time, I had a colleague who was providing therapy for the refugee communities. And it was during those conversations that I really became interested in understanding experiences of refugee families. Now, I'm trained as a family therapist. And so my lens going into this was trying to figure out what should therapists know if they have a refugee family in session. So that's really how I got started working on trying to find more about refugee populations. So I think I have about 20 minutes, is that right? So, and if you have any questions, feel free to ask me at any point. I'm happy to have this as interactive as you want it to be. Just a brief background. Most of you know this already. We have a lot of people being forcibly displaced from countries around the world. The UNHCR has talked about this being an epidemic. In 2014, 60 million people were displaced. The United States hosts the 10th largest population of refugees currently. And as you can see, I've cited your report, in Syracuse, between the periods of 2001 and 2012, about 397 Iraqi refugees were resettled. There are different refugee groups that get resettled in Syracuse. My interest in studying Iraqi refugees was really based on how different that group of refugees is. In our literature, there's a tendency to homogenize refugee populations, refugee groups, and talk about them as one single body. And there are dangers to doing that. We minimize the unique experiences that each of these refugee populations face during pre-migration, flight, and post-migration if we lump them all together into one group. I was particularly interested in the refugees from Iraq because of my own personal interest in the political climate around the Iraq War in 2003. There have been several waves of Iraqi refugees who have resettled in the United States, but post the 2003 war, the current wave of refugees that are being resettled have had different experiences. So I was particularly interested in how those unique circumstances may impact their family relationships. So we know from our from literature, from academic literature, that refugee families face a number of challenges. There are some structural shifts that occur, changes in roles that occur, and in the absence of established social networks, which they lost when they were forcibly displaced, the family becomes a key unit through which they navigate barriers or challenges in the host country. Most of these studies on families, though, were conducted in other countries, Australia, Belgium, Netherlands. These countries seem to be further ahead in terms of researching about refugee families. Studies in the U.S. have mostly focused on Bosnian refugees who were here in the 90s. For some reason, it hasn't picked back up. One of the difficulties that or limitations that I noticed as a researcher and as a family therapist looking at the literature was that a lot of our studies focused on psychopathology. So what's wrong with them in terms of how depressed they are, how much substance abuse there is, and most importantly, symptoms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. For anyone who knows anything about refugee lives or resettlement, it shouldn't come as a surprise that they have experienced severe trauma and therefore will have some. Those will continue to have some effect later on. It comes as no surprise to most people who are familiar with those living conditions. But yet, when we focus primarily on psychopathology, what we are doing is creating the story of the refugees as a vulnerable population that needs to be saved. And while there are some benefits, structural as well as individual benefits to having that story, what we lose is our stories of resilience. A lot of refugees thrive despite the trauma that they've experienced, and they continue to do so for several generations. So my focus, my lens going into the study was to really understand how are family relationships used as resources? How do they experience their families as they resettle in this country? So for my study, I looked at only those who had been resettled in Syracuse post-2003, and only those who had been resettled from Iraq. I had 11 participants in the study, so it's a qualitative study. I wanted to get at their narratives, their stories, really to understand their experiences more in depth. So what that means is that what I'm going to present is really their experience. We cannot generalize it to any other group of refugees, but it gives us a sense of what their experiences are. All except one participant were currently students in local community colleges. I recruited them through community organizations. I actually was fortunate because I had a graduate student who knew people who from Iraq, and that's how I got introduced to my participants. I did not go through interfaith or Catholic charities, primarily because as an outsider to the refugee community, I did not want to come across as a person representing any agency. So I wanted to go in as a researcher curious about their community and not as anyone who may have any kind of authority over their resettlement process. I had 6 male and 5 female participants. The ages range from 21 to 39 years. So I went in with an interview schedule and with the primary goal of trying to understand their family. What came up in all of the interviews initially was their need to talk about their trauma. Their need to talk about the experiences they had prior to resettlement in the U.S. So even though it was not my intention to get those stories, there was a need for them to talk about it. So it's interwoven in their stories, their experiences of trauma and loss. It was interesting to me how they responded. They saw me as a researcher. So since most of them were students, they thought they would help me by helping me, complete the study, really, which I was really grateful for. But many of the men also wanted to educate me about the sociopolitical climate, which I thought was very helpful for me to learn, because I didn't know a lot of things, and I definitely didn't know what their experience was. So It was a great learning experience for me too. So why did these people leave? The context of displacement, there were themes related to fear and loss. For instance, this is a quote from one person: "We fled to Jordan in the middle of the night so that no one can notice. We didn't tell anybody because there was a lack of trust. We left everything. We didn't take clothes. We left everything, our house, our belongings, everything there." So most of them had to leave their homes within a matter of days. Many of them had received threats. A couple of them had been kidnapped and held for ransom. A couple of others had been shot at or had witnessed shooting of a family member. And all of these things really started after the war was officially declared over. So after the war was officially declared over, there was a period of power vacuum in Iraq, which led to the rise of militia, and ethnic tensions really rose during that time period. They all talked about how before the war, there wasn't as many divisions as we see today. The different ethnicities, the Shias, the Sunnis, intermingled. And in families, they had multiple ethnicities within their own families. But once the tension started, people started turning on each other. And there was at least one person who said, "I didn't know if I could trust my own extended family because I knew of one of my cousins killing someone else." So these tensions started post the war. And there was this uncertainty of who the perpetrators were. For many of them, for instance, one participant said, "I didn't even recognize their accents. They were clearly not from Iraq." So we don't really know who was perpetrating these acts of violence, but what was certain was a threat of violence. So they knew they had to leave, and some of them had to leave within a couple of days. The lack of trust there is really something important for us to remember. The lack of trust which they experienced pre-migration and during flight seems to have carried over post-migration as well. So there's a lack of community. It seems like there's a lack of community-level trust. In some of the studies that I've looked at, what helps refugees reestablish their lives in the host countries, they talk about community-level trust as being one of the main factors. If they have a community in the host country, that helps them navigate barriers. But here in this population, we're seeing that there is no such support to speak of, at least in the Syracuse area. The other areas, as the story may be different. All of them also still have families back in Iraq, and it's impossible for them to not think about it and constantly worry about them. My data collection started in 2014, and around that time, the threat of ISIS really emerged as a very strong one in Iraq. And every interview I went, all the interviews were conducted, most of the interviews were conducted in their homes. They would have the television on and they would have the news on at all times. There's this constant worry for the families that they had left behind. And so, despite that, they had to continue living their lives here. This is one participant who talks about there is no way to forget. There is no way to put everything behind. We do expect refugees who are resettled here to quickly put their lives together and move on and get a job, move out of the apartment, make yourselves useful citizens. But when that expectation is there, we forget that these are profound traumas that stay with them and they carry with them for the rest of their lives and into several generations. The same participant noted that his daughter asked him to put her in a DHL box and send her back to her grandmother, who was still in Iraq. And this particular daughter grew up, spent a few years in Iraq, and still had memories of that time, as opposed to her younger sister, who did not have many memories of Iraq, and so did not miss Iraq as much. So we see that the age at which children are resettled, that could also impact how they construct their lives here. So what happens to family relationships within this context of loss and trauma? Almost all of the participants, except one, almost all of them said, we are like one unit. So one participant said, my wife is my brother, my sister, my mother, my uncle, my father, because there's no one else here, really. That, as well, added to the fact that there is lower community level trust. Even if they were to go out, who are they going to socialize with? Who are they going to trust? All of these factors led to strengthening of their family relationship. So they became closer, parents and children developed a closer bond. Parents talked about how the children would go to them if they experienced any difficulties in school, and the parents would sit together with the children to brainstorm solutions. So there's a strengthening of the bond between them. They relied on each other. So it's important to note that all refugees are not granted asylum, along with their family members. There are the different policies regarding how to grant asylum, and especially if they're above the age of 18, they may not necessarily move with their family. So this is, again, we have to re-examine our own definitions of adulthood. We, in this country, 18 is when you become an adult and independent, so you're supposed to make your own decisions afterwards. But then that's not how it works. For instance, even in India, where I am from, children do not leave their parents' home until after they get married, or they choose to do a PhD in another country. But yeah, if I weren't doing that, I would still be living in my parents' home, very much dependent on my parents. And so in the collectivist cultures, adulthood happens very late, or it happens at a different time, or the markers are different. So that's something for us to examine when we talk about families and who constitutes families. So what they also talked about is this beginning of a shift in gender roles. For instance, this one person said, I do the laundry. If I were in Iraq, people would laugh at me. So there's a shift in the roles, with the male participants taking on more responsibility for looking after the children, helping them with the homework, picking them up from school, helping them with cooking. And the women also are being more active outside of the home, which is different from how it is for them in Iraq. So they learn to drive, they take ESL classes, they join universities, and they go out grocery shopping on their own, all of which is not the norm for them. But this does not necessarily indicate a change in the patriarchal system. So the shift in the gender roles is understood as something that they need to do in order to survive. So for the man, I need to do the laundry, I need to help cook, because there's no one else here, and I am the man, I am the head of the household, I am responsible for everything, which includes doing the chores. So even though we notice some shifts, the underlying process of patriarchy, the structure of patriarchy, has not yet changed. So for instance, one of the participants talked about nothing really has changed. If we need anything, we ask my father. If he says it's okay, we do it. If not, no. So the hierarchy is still the same, with the man being the head of the household, or the elders being the head of the household in some cases. And it's not just that, but there's also this desire to maintain their legacy as a Muslim and Iraqi. But for many of them, it's not as clear-cut. What I noticed in their narratives was this struggle between needing to remember their past, because they're so, that's who they are. That's their identity. Being from Iraq is their identity. So there's this need to remember, but there's also this need to forget, because unless they forget some aspects of it, they cannot possibly rebuild again here. So there's a struggle between how much do I retain, how much should I give up, and this struggle is also seen in their interactions and communications between parent and child. So how much about our past should I share with my children? Many of them who were parents, were open to sharing about their experiences, but in age-appropriate ways. But what they were most intent on sharing was their legacy of being a Muslim and of being an Iraqi. They wanted to make sure that their children did not forget where they came from or who they are. So this desire is there very strongly for the parents. So if you think about this as what the implications could be for the children, there's a strong desire. So they're hearing from the family that it's important to maintain, have some connection to the past, to have some connection to their religion and to their heritage. And yet they're in a country where those very same identities that are important to them are discriminated against. So they're growing up in an environment where they experience discrimination based on religion, based on how they look. For instance, some of the participants, some of the women talked about being asked about their hijab. People talking to them about, why do you wear the hijab? And the other people, a couple of others who were students, talked about experiencing some subtle forms of discrimination in the classroom, which they really couldn't pinpoint because it's subtle. You know, it's not an overt go back to your country kind of thing. It's more a gaze of you are the other, so I need to stay away from you. That kind of discrimination is harder to identify and have a dialogue about. But those are the kinds of things that they have to live with. So there are these multiple layers. So there's this prevalence of an attitude towards them that's not necessarily always pleasant, but there's also this desire to retain, who their identity, who they are. And at the same time, despite all the struggles, they feel profoundly grateful for the opportunities that they have been given here. The idea of safety, the word safety came up numerous times in all of the interviews. What safety means to them when they move to the U.S. So despite all the other difficulties that they have, all of them unanimously expressed how grateful they are for the resources that they have here, for the resources that that their children have. What I see is multiple levels where there could be internal conflict about how to make sense of all of this. And so my thinking is just talking to them at one point in time, a few years into their resettlement, is not enough. So we need to understand how this plays out in the longer run. So maybe conducting more longitudinal studies, gathering their stories, talking to their children about how they experience those conflicts and how then meaning is made out of those conflicts. That really is the direction that I think I'm going in next. So just a few things to consider. For those working with refugees, it's really important to think about the context of their displacement. It's also important to note that there could be some structural changes in the family. Acknowledging experiences of discrimination in the host country is important. There's also this issue that for some refugees, when they move to the host country, there is a significant change in their status. They move from being either middle class or upper middle class to a lower class when they move to the host country, and that can have a profound impact on their lives. So it's important for us to think about that, to consider that as well. And as a researcher, all these stories about the struggles, I think, raise a challenge to this notion of acculturation and what we expect from those who move from another country into the United States. I'm going to stop here, but I'm open for questions here.
I really had two questions. Is there a definition of what a refugee is? I get concerned about, is it somebody that's expecting to be permanently relocated and resettled and really grow into whatever place they are, or the expectation that this is somewhat temporary, maybe even 5 years being temporary, but then to go back to the home? The second thing I had was just in the study group you had all were college students. Does that have an impact on how you interpolate among the whole community as well?
Thank you. I'm going to answer the second question first. And definitely, this is a fairly homogeneous sample. And I think I got this sample because my sampling strategy was word of mouth. So I go to one person, they refer me to someone else. And that's something to keep in mind. So this experience is limited to them. It may not reflect the experiences of others. The first question, the definition, I wish I had the definition up there. It's from the UNHCR. A refugee is someone who is forced to flee because of threats of persecution and a few other things which the Refugee Convention listed in 1951. And the U.S. and a few other countries were signatories to that declaration. So what that means is that the signatories have an obligation to provide refuge for anyone who is experiencing threats of persecution due to war, whatever the other reasons are. Once they come in as either an asylee or they're granted refuge, they have a path to citizenship. So many of my participants had already become citizens. So they become citizens of the host country. And there is no obligation for them to move back. For many of them, especially now, there is really no hope for them to go back. And what would they go back to, especially in Iraq? In Iraq, there's not just been forced displacement out of the country, there's also been internal displacement. So that means people have left their neighborhoods and perhaps gone into hiding or just have lost their homes. So what would they go back to? There is no obligation, there is no intention when that, or there is no expectation that they would go back.
I kind of wanted to follow up on that. I can't imagine what it's like to be a refugee fleeing from persecution or terror. And yet I have lived abroad. I've lived away from my native country and fervently hoped. I mean, I wasn't forced to go. My father had an opportunity. My fondest wish was to come back home. Now, you've kind of answered the question about the refugees in your sample, apparently not planning, not having that as their goal to be reunited in their homeland. their native land. I'm wondering about the refugees in Jordan or in Turkey or Lebanon, whether I somehow think there's not a similar resettlement program going on over there, and if there's an expectation that those the refugees resettle in that area are temporary, or there is this kind of expectation that they will return. And if a refugee gets this far away from home, and I know we've been criticized for not taking enough, certainly given our role in Iraq and the Middle East, but is the expectation, if you're coming this far, you're not going back?
That's such a great question. So Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, they're not signatories of the convention. So they're not obligated to keep them. And there's been a lot of difficulties because of that. So, for instance, what's happening in Turkey now is they're choosing to change some of the policies related to resettlement. And they've also blocked some applications that the U.S. had approved for some Syrians to come to the U.S. So it's complicated to say the least, and they're not under any obligation. So when these participants moved to Turkey or Jordan or Syria before their conflicts began in 2011, the adults were not, for the few years initially, they were able to work, but then after that they weren't able to find employment, but the children could go to schools. So this expectation was that that's temporary, that they were just there until they were resettled in a different country. Jay, you had something to say?
Yeah.
Just a few weeks back, I went to the New York to participate in our national BOLAC. Episcopal Migrational Ministry has organized a national level of conference, and I was a panelist. And we have a representative from UN, special advisor to the Ban Ki-moon, and this year's summit was the president encouraged many of the European countries who has never resettled the refugees in the past to be on the team to resettle the new refugees. And these people were there to listen, to hear our story being successful in this country and what is the best practice that we have done in our grassroots level to help, to support, and to integrate into the local communities. And that found that we have the best practice system in U.S. that in the grassroots level, like the community groups, the faith groups, the church, there are different the ethnic groups that formed their own community groups come together and support each other and help to integrate and to help them to start the new life. That's how I started my new life. I was supported by you all. So that was my experience that I told to them, and that was the best that they got from the conference, that the most of the local partners, local groups, church, the cities, counties, state are deeply engaged and involved to help the new refugees to integrate and to start the new life.
I would be very interested in your comments about how their ability to speak our language or inability when they first arrive works into all those elements that you mentioned as they move along in the process.
So that's the other thing that that I did not mention was that I don't speak Arabic, and most of these interviews that I conducted with them, all except two, I conducted in English. excuse me. So this group of Iraqi refugees, again, this is different because they know a little more English, especially the men, compared to others. So that became an advantage But for those who did not, especially there's one person who was highly qualified. He was a teacher in a particular subject back in Iraq, but he was he used to teach in Arabic. He did not know English, and he's back here now. He's here now, unable to be a teacher because he doesn't know the language. So in that particular family, the roles are reversed, where because his wife knows more English, she's able to take on more of a leadership role outside compared to, you know, what he still considers himself the head of the household. But some of the instrumental roles are taken on by his wife because of that difference. And I think the that's one main barrier that's identified by all refugee groups is that inability to speak English, which becomes a huge barrier in navigating our societal structures and institutions here. So in answer to your question, yes, it does play a huge role in all of these struggles, yeah.
My question is two-part question. The first part is, these people that when they left their homes, there was something severe that happened to them that forced them to leave their country. And when they moved to another country, the host country, they still find this criticism or some sort of you're not wanted for the majority of them. They find it hard to settle in the community. My question is, what kind of effect does that have on these people when they try to settle, like you're here, but you don't belong here? And the other part, your study is on educated people. Were they forced to go to college so they can actually survive, or did they come from an educated family and they wanted to continue? Because one of yours, probably at least one, is almost 40 years old.
Right.
So what forced them to go back to go to college?
So your second question was about their education. Some of their reasons were mixed. So some of them wanted to go back in order to get a certificate because their educational degrees were not recognized in the U.S. So even though some of them had graduate degrees, it didn't matter really because it was not recognized in the U.S. So some of them went back as a necessity to have those credentials so they could find better jobs. For the younger participants, it was more of continuing their education. But for the older ones, it was because of a necessity to get better jobs. First question was about how do they make sense when they're pushed out of the country and then they get this message that they're not wanted here. And I think that is this big question about what kind of effect that could have on a person's, not just individual psyche, but also relationships. What I found was, and this is my interpretation based on, you know, based on my lens, but what I found that there was this kind of loyalty struggle almost. I'm safe here, so I owe a lot to the U.S., I'm safe here. No one's threatening me, at least as directly as they did back home. So I'm safe. I have access to education. My children can do well. So I'm deeply grateful for this country. But at the same time, I'm experiencing these things that I did not experience back home, you know, being targeted because of my race, religion, the way I look. My interpretation is that because of their lack of power currently in the society, their voices of being targeted or being discriminated may not be heard. They may actually not talk about it because they may feel either that I've gained so much I have no right to complain, or they may feel that their position may be in jeopardy if they complain. Does that make sense? My guess is that those acts of discrimination may remain hidden because of that, and I'm interested to see how that plays out in parent-child relationships as well, and how that continues over a period of time. But that is a really great question. Thank you.
You made a statement early about how people lost their sense of complete loss of trust in others. It surprised me how much you referenced even failure to trust their own families in some ways. What were the issues that tore families apart? Was it religious, political? What was it?
All of those. So what happened post the 2003 war was because of a complex set of political issues, different ethnic groups started turning against each other. And before that, there were these ethnic groups within a given family. So, for instance, there could be a Shia uncle married to a Sunni aunt. And they would raise their kids according to whatever they thought was best. There were no norms or rules related to how they would raise their kids. Or there was a Kurdish wife married to an Arabic man, and their families coexisted. But once the tension started, they noticed that people were turning against each other within the families. As I mentioned, one of the participants talked about knowing about a cousin who had killed someone, one of his family members who belonged to a different ethnic group. So those kinds of incidents made it hard for them to trust anyone apart from their immediate family.
Thank you. This is quite interesting. I want to focus a little bit more on the discussion of, you mentioned that the patriarchy was very much intact in these families. And what I've heard from some other families in other ethnic groups, refugees, is that the actual dynamics of parental authority over children are oftentimes subverted in interesting ways that make it difficult for parents to do the things we expect of parents in this community or this country, especially reinforcing homework and things like that. And oftentimes it seems like it's partly language and partly savvy, where the parents are not familiar with those customs and expectations enough, and the children can kind of, whether it's translating for them at a medical appointment or misinterpreting what their actual homework is. But it seems like you didn't experience that so much here, and I'm wondering to what extent is it, are these the middle, is this a three generation, and these are people who are empowered enough with language to be in a university setting? And does that sort of help guard against that? So I was wondering if you could speak about that.
Absolutely, and that's the answer to your question. most of them, the parents, and this is important because you're absolutely right. In some other refugee communities, that authority does get subverted, and children become parentified in some ways. In this sample, at least, since the parents had a better grasp of the language, they were students themselves, they belonged to a different class in Iraq. So their authority still remained intact. But I also have to say that this is just this one point in time that I examined. They had been in the United States for 6 years at the minimum. And I think it would be really interesting to see how that changes with time as children become more adept at navigating the challenges in the United States and the parents, kind of are stuck in a particular generation. That could change over time. Having said that, so other studies that I've looked at, for instance, the Vietnamese refugees who have been resettled and they've been here for a long period of time, they have noticed that over a period of time, that patriarchal structure does change. And when that changes, there are more conflicts, especially between couples. So that does change over a period of time. At this point, it didn't seem like it had, but over a period of time it could. Thank you.
You had mentioned that they leave their homes with barely the clothes on their back. What are some of the mechanics or pathways that determines whether they arrive in London or Syracuse or Philadelphia with no means of being able to pay for that?
That's such a great question again. So these participants, many of them were able to drive to Jordan or move to Turkey with all their savings, essentially, the money and whatever they could carry with them. Once they reach those countries, they apply for asylum status, and I'm sure there are members in the audience who know about this more than I do, they don't necessarily get to pick what city they resettle in. Some of the participants have said that they have had a choice between the U.S. and the U.K., for instance, and they chose to come to the U.S., but they don't necessarily get to pick which city unless they have a family member. Or in the case of the Iraqi refugees, if they've helped the U.S. Army in some way, they may get special accommodations. Their requests may be honored. Jay, you have.
I'd just like to add on the Iraqi refugee. As I said before, I was on the panelist, and the other friend was on the panel. He was from Iraq, and he was a refugee, and he was, I think he's been here for like just 1 year. And what he told to the group was he had some money to flew back to Turkey and he saved his life. But the other friend who didn't have a money, he was killed in Iraq. So that was the story. So as you said, if they have some sort of manageable some way to flee, there's some of them, they saved the life, who don't, they were killed. So that was the story. Regarding the how they we pick up is, I love you. So why I love you, I was given options, 7 countries, Australia, New Zealand, Norway, Denmark, U.S., and I choose U.S. because I want to become a U.S. citizen and to be in the freedom in the world. So we don't often get must like go to Syracuse, go to New York, go to Texas, but is well the International Organization for Migration, when they process the screening, all the process is done. If we have a U.S. tie, who is a very close member to the cities where they have been already resettled, we can get choose to go there. But if not, the IOM and the National BOLAC, the National 9 BOLAC we have in the U.S., they will designate to the different cities, and we don't know until we get to the city where we are. So
we're going to have, we are actually out of time, but we're going to take this one more question from this young lady.
It's not actually a question. I was born in Bhutan, and my family was forced to leave Bhutan due to political situation, and we were a refugee in Nepal, and Mr. Subedi is my caseworker. After we flew to U.S., we were given a package. We didn't have to pay at the same time. So after we came here and started working, we paid like $20 per month or some whatever we could, and there wasn't any interest for that.
Thank you very much, Rashmi, for such a great presentation.